DNA analysis shows that the last woolly mammoths, even those that lived in Asia, were all genetically North American. With me now to explain what that means and why it flies in the face of what scientists had previously believed about woolly mammoth migration is Ross McPhee, curator of mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When did woolly mammoths become extinct?
Well, on this continent, they became extinct around 10,000 years ago.
So there were already humans around at the time.
Yes, humans probably got into North America as early as 13,000 and perhaps even earlier. It's very controversial. But the thing about mammoths is that they weren't limited to North America. They had a distribution that included all of the northern tier of Asia into Europe as far as Spain and Britain. They were a very highly distributed species.
And where did they begin?
Well, mammoths per se, as compared to what we regard as true elephants, namely the African and Asian elephant lineages, seem to have begun in Africa, of all places, maybe on the order of 5 or 6 million years ago. From there, they got into Asia. They differentiated. The iconic mammoth is the woolly mammoth, but that was a very late species. It's only about 400,000 years old. The others were very much older, had different kinds of adaptations, and lived in different parts of the total mammoth range.
So the ones that we're talking about crossed the Bering land bridge and came into the Americas and then somehow became distinct from the ones that remained back in Asia?
This is the completely fascinating thing. When you're looking only at bones and teeth, you can make no good inferences about what we call population level factors or resemblances among different members of the same species. The bones and teeth are just no good for that purpose. What ancient DNA has given us is an actual insight into the details of how these populations were structured. And there's an amazing number of things that are turning over all of our kind of conventional preconceptions about how such populations were put together.
Well, how much DNA can you get from a fossil? I spoke with an archaeologist recently who found fossilized coprolites, human feces, in a cave in Oregon, and he was very excited because he said that gave him better DNA samples than just bones would.
Well, you have a large number of problems with doing ancient DNA work that only begin with actually finding something that might have DNA in it. It all depends what's
Most
happened to the sample.
Most fossils don't, because they're really a replacement of the original bone material with outside minerals.
That's absolutely true. So far, about the earliest successful extraction of what we call host DNA, the DNA that actually belongs to the animal in question, only goes back on the order of 100,000 to 200,000 years, which seems like a lot, but really isn't from a paleontological point of view, because the DNA molecule is not very stable once the organism is dead. It begins to fragment. But that's only part of the problem. There's a whole series of classes of what we call inhibitors because they inhibit the kinds of reactions we need to use to make enough of the DNA to do any kind of scientific work with it. And that's the problem. So in your coprolite example, it does tend to be true that coprolites do preserve DNA very well, but bones aren't bad either.
And I understand new techniques have allowed us to do a lot more than in the past. So what have we learned? Now, we had these woolly mammoths coming over to the Americas and then becoming a distinct group. And
yes.
And what are the markers that tell us that these are North American mammoths?
Okay, so in order, the first North American mammoths seem to have popped over the Bering land bridge between Asia and North America in the site of where the Bering Sea is now. Probably around 300,000 years ago. The fossil record would only support maybe 200,000, but for various reasons, we think it had to have been earlier. Having gotten over here, they differentiated because there was really very limited contact, it seems, between the ancestral populations in Siberia and the ones that got over to effectively the New World. And what that meant over time, just for any, you could see it in practically any species you'd want to talk about, when you have this long-term separation, they tend to start going in their own way. And we can detect that genetically. We can find genetic markers that will help in defining, much like a fingerprint, exactly what population you belong to.
And at a certain point, the Siberian mammoths became extinct.
Well, that is the next part of the story. And this is something we're still trying to conjure with because it is so unexpected. here's what happened in a nutshell. It seems that over a period of time, the North Americans indeed did go their own way. But then,
and they were thriving.
And then they got back into Siberia, which is not so remarkable because the land bridge was still up. But after a point, and we don't know exactly when this point occurred, but after a point, maybe as recently as 40-odd thousand years ago, even perhaps suddenly, all of the distinctive fingerprints for the Asian original mammoth-style populations seem to disappear, in the sense that in our samples we found no further indications that they continued to exist. So it's a replacement phenomenon where all of the original members of the same species, this is an important point to make, the same species disappeared, they left, and in come these guys from the Americas, and they do very well. And you don't even see this in the fossil record. You just see continuity because, as I said originally, you can't tell from the bones who came from where.
Now, I would have assumed that they went extinct because they were hunted into extinction, but then that wouldn't explain the fact that these other woolly mammoths came back and lived many, many thousands of years past that. Could they have interbred?
Absolutely. And that's, in fact, what you'd expect to see, that there would be evidence of interbreeding and that you'd have hybrids, in effect. And we don't see that. We just see that they drop out, that the original Eurasian populations just drop out completely. Now, there is another part to this story. Something similar seems to have gone on in bison and in bears and in horses. And by that, I mean,
but weren't they originally, didn't they originally develop in the Americas and then just go to Asia?
No. Let's take a look at horses. Horses, in fact, in many ways are an extremely interesting example of what may be the same phenomenon. Horses did originate in the New World. The family Equidae is North American. The horse that we think of as being the horse, the domestic horse, Equus caballus, arose on this continent several hundred thousand years ago. It got over the land bridge going west and did very well in Eurasia. But around 10,000, all of the horses in the New World, including ones that got down into South America, suddenly disappeared, along with the saber-toothed cats, the mastodons, the mammoths. They all went out. But the horses living in the Old World survived. 500 years ago, they were brought back home. And they've done very well on this continent since then. But it's a very similar phenomenon, and for reasons that we really have almost no grasp of as to why you get these huge numbers of animals very well distributed over continental areas, apparently suddenly disappearing in that part of the range but doing okay in the rest of
it. You don't think they were hunted into extinction? They were not domesticated in the New World, but in Asia, obviously, they became domesticated animals and the favorite means of transportation.
Only very much later. Domestication didn't start for horses until about 6,000 years ago.
You're ruining all my theories.
I have that as my job.
Now, how does the recent information that we have learned based on this DNA information change what scientists previously thought?
Well, you know, the honest answer is that we just didn't think about it because we had no way, when just looking at bones and teeth, to make any inferences about population. So it was guessed because mammoths, woolly mammoths in this case, arose in Asia that, okay, they got over the Bering land bridge. That's very interesting. But, you know, the American population was just the sideshow, that the action in terms of evolutionary development really all happened in Eurasia. What the changeover in interpretation is now, that has nothing to do with origins. We still think that woolly mammoths originated in Eurasia, but it's this replacement phenomenon where you have all of the Eurasian members of the species disappearing, but then being apparently very rapidly replaced by their relatives from North America. It's just an astounding changeover in anything that we could have extracted from bones and teeth.
And everyone seems to be going along with this, or are there some people who are not accepting this approach, this theory?
Well, one very good criticism is our sample large enough? Well, our sample was about 160 specimens, which may not sound like a lot, but it is by far the largest DNA study, ancient DNA study, of this type that's ever been tried. It's not so easy to get good samples. This is the point. And it would still amount to not very much if there wasn't this similar patterning of complete replacement with other species of large mammals. And that's what gives it some legs as an interpretation. There was something going on in the ice ages that resulted in these enormous collapses that we really, as modern humans, have no understanding of. This is not extinction merely. This is replacement, which is a different phenomenon often and very much more complicated to explain in the way that it's emerging.
But then extinction. And but the extinction is about 10,000 years ago in the Americas and in Siberia at the same time?
Well, not exactly. Yes, there was collapse in both Eurasia and in North America, but there was some survival on small Arctic islands like Wrangel Island in the Arctic Ocean north of Siberia and Bering Sea islands until very much later, or comparatively very much later, until 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. So what can we say? Mammoths seem to have been comparatively resilient. Anybody who can live in the far north under these conditions would have to be. They did eventually get completely exterminated, but was it one factor operating at one time? Was it several factors operating at different times? These are the scientifically interesting questions that we can now really attack with ancient DNA work.
Can we find out whether disease caused this kind of mass extinction or whether it was changing weather patterns?
Well, interestingly, disease may in fact have played a role. Emerging diseases that populations on different sides of the Bering Strait were not well adapted to. Once again, from a scientific point of view, it's not just enough to say diseases might have done it. You want actual evidence. And so far, we have nothing persuasive.
Well, the woolly mammoths all across North America, I seem to remember reading that Charles Wilson Peale, one of the first major American painters, opened a natural history museum in Philadelphia. And his first major exhibit was a woolly mammoth skeleton.
I hate to be difficult, but it was a mastodon.
Oh, gee.
Which is a different kind of proboscidian. But yes, they were very successful. The major factor affecting their distribution was the ice, because from time to time, the North American ice cap expanded to an enormous extent, covered virtually all of Canada, right down to the northern tier of the U.S. around 20,000 years ago. But mammoths have been here, or were here, for a comparatively long period of time. And during the better times, as it were, when the ice cap was smaller, they were able to distribute themselves much more widely. Now, it doesn't seem to, however, and this is the important point, made any difference to them. Whether it was cold or warm, they did very well. And again, from the ancient DNA perspective, we actually have some information on this now. And it doesn't seem as though mammoths, at least on this continent, were going down the tubes shortly before their extinction. They were still genetically very diverse.
Now, we call them woolly mammoths. Do we have examples of their wool?
Yes, we do, from both North America and Siberia.
And is it the same, pretty much? Wouldn't you get DNA information from the hairs?
Yes, you would. And recently, people have been very successful in doing that. We preferred to work with bone because this is a material that my group has worked with a lot. Obviously, in future, we will use hair as well. Hair is a little bit more problematic to deal with in only one sense, which is that you really need apparently very good circumstances of preservation in order to get hair, or at least a lot of hair. Whereas with bones, they just seem to have, they're better from a preservational point of view.
Well, since I got that whole thing wrong about the mastodon, what is the difference between a mastodon and a mammoth?
Well,
aren't they both related to elephants?
Yes. Well, we call them proboscideans because actually mastodons are not all that closely related to elephants. But this is a technical question. Here's an easy way to distinguish the two. True elephants, which would include mammoths, have teeth that are made up of a whole series of complicated lamellae or plates of enamel. And they're very efficient grinding teeth. With mastodons, the teeth are much more like ours. They have these little hillocks called cusps, and there's only a thin plate of enamel over the core of the tooth. So adaptationally, they were quite different. Elephants can truly eat anything in the vegetable line, even the bark off trees. Mastodons would have been much more limited. They would have largely preferred, I'm sure, much softer forms of vegetation. In fact, that's where we tend to find their bones, as in the case of Peale's mastodon, which was found in what had previously been a swamp. So when you pick up a very large proboscidian tooth, just look at the top of it. If it's got lots of lamellae, it's an elephant. If it doesn't, it's a mastodon.
I'll try to remember that the next time I find a proboscidian tooth. By the way, we have a photo of a woolly mammoth fossil posted on our show page at WNYC.org, courtesy of the American Museum of Natural History. You might want to check that out and see what we've been talking about. My great thanks to Ross McPhee, who's the curator of mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Len.